Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to The Big Three, or if you're visiting and joining us for the first time, great to have you with us as we do indeed unpack three questions from Sunday's sermon. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do so. We continued our series entitled The Fruit of the Spirit, A Life Changed by Jesus on Sunday, and looked in Galatians 5 at the other list. So you have the list of the fruit of the Spirit, and you'll love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, gentleness, and whatnot. And earlier in the section, Paul includes a list of, I guess, what we would call vices, starting with sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, and then a whole set of vices like hatred and discord and factionalism and whatnot that have community impact to them, and then wraps the list up with a couple of other kind of, you know, significantly different vices, drunkenness, orgies, and the like, Paul goes on to say. And so we spent some time thinking about, and I spent some time reflecting on, why Paul includes this obvious list, which he says are obvious things, and suggested that there's a gap between the acts of the flesh that Paul lists there. He doesn't tell us the fruit of those actions. He gives us the fruit of the Spirit, but doesn't give us the actions of the Spirit that lead to that fruit. And I think that there's some valuable space there for us to be reflecting on, I guess, the fruit of our actions. What are the actions that we're engaged in? Are they anything close to that list? And if not, are they the sorts of actions that will lead to the fruit of the Spirit, particularly in community, which seems to be a big part of Paul's focus here? So the three questions that were raised kind of relate to some of those ideas, as you would expect, because there are three questions from that sermon. So here we go. Could Paul's letter to the church be a passive-aggressive response to the sins the church could have done? For example, they might have acted with hatred. A good question to ask. I mean, I had mentioned that there may have been something that Paul was addressing, some sort of specific piece, but it's a great way to answer, sort of ask that question, and gives us an opportunity to reflect a little bit on Paul's rhetorical style and strategy. So we'll get into that in a moment. Secondly, we've looked at the same text for 2 weeks and haven't addressed Paul's interest in the law. What does the law have to do or not with the fruit of the Spirit? So the we're using, obviously, this text essentially from a topical perspective to look at the fruit of the Spirit and a few surrounding issues, such as the role of the Spirit in the fruit. We've looked at fruitfulness itself and whatnot. So we haven't addressed every aspect within the text, but there are a couple of places where Paul makes reference to the law, particularly at the end of the list of the fruit of the Spirit. He states that against these things against which there is no law. Okay, what is he saying about that? He mentions the law a little bit earlier in the passage as well. So we'll reflect a bit on that, because I think that helps set in I guess it sets in context the conversation that Paul is having. And then third, the vices are obvious, except in us. No one thinks they're in a faction, idolatrous, sexually immoral, etc. and so forth. Yet we know these exist in the church. How do we do better? Which is a good question to ask as well. How do we, in the terms of Jesus, how do we make sure that we take the log out of our own eye before we take the speck out of others, but how do we do that more effectively? So those are the questions that we'll be grappling with over the next 30 minutes or so. So let's get stuck in. So could Paul's letter to the church be a passive-aggressive response to sins the church could have done? In other words, for example, they might have acted with hatred. The short answer is no. I don't believe that Paul would have acted in a passive-aggressive way. The long answer, or the longer answer, is that Paul was very careful about how he addressed potential sins. I mean, I think we've all experienced this. You know, maybe you've had a close friend and they've been doing something that's, even if it's not, you know, even if it's not immoral or wicked or, you know, sinful, it's not smart. If you've ever had to have a conversation with anybody to try to correct them, that's tricky, isn't it? If you're an employer and you've had to have that conversation with an employee, right? If you've had to have that conversation with a colleague or a classmate, you know, someone working on a project with you, like those are really difficult conversations at the best of times. And for Paul, not only is he, in many instances in the epistles, the letters of the New Testament, is he writing to address not just theological concerns, he's not just writing to address, you know, the way that they think about things, he's often addressing the way in which they act. And as I suggested on Sunday, there's some evidence that there were some community issues in the church or the churches in Galatia. All right. The fact that Paul focuses, you know, at the start of the section, verses 13 and 14, you know, on warning them, you know, don't bite and devour each other. He talks about love and how that's the opposite, and how humbly serving others in love is the opposite to the desires of the flesh. So there seems to be something going on there. Paul, of course, was addressing a serious concern, he was trying to address a serious concern that's always difficult to do, but he was trying to do that from a distance. Like he wasn't even in the room. He's trying to address a serious problem via email, right? Like he's all he can do is he can write this thing out. In the early church, in the Greco-Roman world in particular, one of the principal elements of an education, if you got one, was rhetoric, which is the art and science of persuasive speech. And over the last 20 or 30 years in particular, there's been a bit of a revival of sorts in New Testament scholarship to try to identify the rhetorical conventions, the strategies and the techniques that Paul uses in his letters. It's quite likely that the letters that he wrote were read aloud to the recipients, most likely by someone who had been with Paul. So Paul would write the letter, you know, I'm going to say in prison because he was often in prison. Galatians, I don't believe, was written from prison, but nonetheless, he writes the letter and then he would send it with an emissary, with someone who would represent him. And that representative would read the text and would not just kind of read it in a flat kind of way, but read it with the meaning and feeling that it was meant to have. In other words, you can think of the epistles a little bit like sermons. Obviously, they have formal elements of greetings and farewells and other bits and pieces. But Paul uses a whole bunch of strategies, rhetorical strategies, to address those really tough issues. So, you know, what we read here in Galatians in chapter 5 may very well be a reflection of some of Paul's rhetorical strategies. So there were strategies. There was one, I'm just trying to remember all the rhetorical conventions that I have come across. There was something called an insinuato, right? Where you would basically insinuate something, right? Which I suppose in a certain light could look passive aggressive, right? But you would insinuate yourself or your point inside of another point. Right. So, you know, there'd be this sense of, you know, talking about, you know, the general way we ought to live, but then insinuating within that there was, you know, some problems that needed to be addressed. Paul would often talk about and use the persuasive techniques wrapped around his own personal ethos, right? Which is the gentle persuasion that is associated with the speaker, reminding them about, you know, the kind of person that he was and about their relationship that they had and about how much he loved them and how much they loved him. And right. And there's quite a bit of that in the early sections of Galatians. There's kind of a long historical prologue to what he's addressing. to remind them, like, I have your best intentions in mind, and you know how much I love you, and therefore what I'm about to say needs to be read in that light. So I do think that Paul, I don't think Paul was being passive aggressive, at least not in that standard kind of way. But I do believe that he would have been utilizing whatever rhetorical conventions and strategies were at his disposal to be able to address the serious concerns that he had. I mean, it's one of the things that marks the epistles. The epistles are not just examples of Paul, you know, sitting down bored one day and thinking, I'm just going to jot down some theology. He's always addressing an issue or several issues, and understanding what that issue is can actually be quite helpful. Part of what was framing up the letter to the Galatians is that while Paul had come and had been a missionary to that group of people, and they had accepted the claims of the gospel, had received the Holy Spirit, it seems that there were some probably Jewish Christians who had come in and basically had suggested that they had missed a step in their salvation and that they needed to, first of all, essentially become Jewish. If you were going to follow Jesus, you needed to be Jewish because Jesus was Jewish and the Messiah, he was the Jewish Messiah, the fulfillment of the Jewish scriptures and all of those sorts of things. And so the idea that Paul was writing to address is to correct not only this kind of false teaching, but also to draw them back to a clearer way of living like Jesus. And it's actually that link with the Jewish Christians and the relationship to Judaism that leads into our second question. So we've looked at the same text for 2 weeks and haven't addressed Paul's interest in the law. What does the law have to do or not with the fruit of the Spirit? As I finished with that in the first question, Paul is in part writing Galatians to correct them, to remind them of how they were saved, that they weren't saved by observing the law, they were saved by faith. Earlier in the letter, he talks about the example of Abraham, and he says Abraham was not saved by obeying the law because the law wasn't given until, well, a long time after. He was saved by his faith, his trust, his belief in the promises of God. And he's writing to address that. And the law, in kind of a 30,000 foot level, was a really important tension in the early church. More specifically, the tension between a Jewish expression of Christianity and a Gentile expression of Christianity. Both obviously emphasize faith in Jesus, but there was, if I can oversimplify it, the question about where does Judaism sit? If Jesus is the fulfillment of the Hebrew scriptures, the promises that are found in those scriptures about God's purposes in the world, and if Jesus was Jewish and he obeyed the law, then what does that mean for the expression of faith when we encounter Gentiles? It's all well and good when, basically all the people who you were talking about the gospel with were Jews because they had the same worldview, the same background, the same understanding, and kind of off you went. Once the Gentiles became incorporated into the church, questions around how Jewish believers and Gentile believers kind of hung out together really became really quite critical. So questions around, say, food laws or food regulations in particular were problematic. How do you have the classic potluck if the Gentiles are bringing unclean food to that? And the Jewish believers are like, I can't eat that. And why'd you bring that? And on it went. So Paul has an interest in the law at that kind of high-end level. And as I said earlier, he is writing to address what he sees as a significant slide away from the heart of the gospel, which is faith rather than law. Elsewhere in the New Testament, say in the book of Romans in particular, but you find this tension played out in lots of the epistles, Paul has a great deal to say about the law. Now, as far as Paul is concerned, the law is good, right? It's not a bad thing. It was a gift from God. It was an expression of the relationship that he had with his people. You can't say that the law is wicked or evil or bad. It's a good thing. But by the power of sin in particular, it has been twisted to become, well, to become part of the problem. I think for Paul and the fruit of the Spirit, though, I think the link between the law and the Spirit is an important one to recognize. So the law was given, first of all, as an expression of the relationship between God and his people. The law was never intended to be the mechanism by which that relationship was entered into. In other words, the Old Testament doesn't suggest that you needed to obey the law in order to become part of the people of God, right? In the Old Testament, it was very ethnically based, right? If you were born into the people of Israel, you were part of the people of God. So it wasn't really the question that they were answering. So the law was given to reflect the relationship with God. It was meant to reflect the wide permission, as well as some of the prohibitions for the people who were called by God's name. The law, however, as that expression, could not, and Paul talks about this elsewhere in the New Testament, could not actually bring about the change that was required. So one of the things that you find in the Old Testament and in the New is that people have a heart problem. We our hearts are not turned towards the Lord, and so we don't obey the law. And the law was powerless to change our hearts. It was there. It told us how we should act, how we should live. It outlined the kinds of things that were important and valuable and reflections of God's relationship with us and his plans and purposes in the world and all that. But our hearts could not, were unimpacted by the law. It couldn't change our hearts. It couldn't unharden them, right? It couldn't affect, you know, what's sometimes referred to in the Old and New Testament is the circumcision of our hearts, right? The doing to our hearts, right? That to mark our hearts for God. And that, I think, is probably the clearest connection then to the Spirit. Because as far as Paul is concerned, it is the Spirit that brings life, because it's the Spirit that can actually get at the problem. It can actually get at the heart. It's the Spirit that can transform and renew our hearts in order that the law might, shall we say, find its home in our heart, right? You may have heard me say this before, but the law, the intention of the law was that the people of Israel, the people of God, would become lawless people, not anarchists, you know, just given to do whatever they wanted, but people who no longer required the law to live the right way. The law was meant to be internalized to such a degree that they no longer required it. So the example I often use is of seatbelt regulations. If the federal government this afternoon repealed all of the seatbelt regulations, you no longer had to put one on, you couldn't get a ticket if you didn't have one on, the first thing I'm doing when I get into my car this afternoon to go home after the legislation has been repealed is I'm going to put my seatbelt on. Because to some degree, I have become, and you probably have as well, I have become lawless in regards to seatbelts. I understand the significance of the seatbelt. I recognize how it might very well save my life. I get it. I don't need the law anymore. The law is pointless for me. I'm going to put my seatbelt on because I understand. I've internalized the value. That was always the intention of the law. And so when the Spirit changes our hearts and softens them, right, so that the law can be written on our hearts in accordance with the promises of God in the Old Testament, then the law becomes internalized. And so the life that we are to live, you know, the fruit of the Spirit that Paul lists in Galatians, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control, right, all those things against which there is no law, to some degree, those things get written on our hearts by the Spirit. And so we end up fulfilling the law, even if we don't have the law. The other example I sometimes use is when we are finally in glory, right? When history has wrapped up and the Lord Jesus has returned and we find ourselves in the presence of God and the first miraculous, you know, worship moment has passed and the dust sort of settles and there's a time for some announcements about life in heaven. God is not going to take some time or send an angel out to remind us of all the things we can and can't do. We will have become lawless people in heaven because finally our hearts will be fully obedient and attuned to God. There will be no need for the law anymore because we will do the sorts of things that we ought to do. We will want to do those things and there will be no impediment to it. And so I believe that that's the link, that the Spirit is what brings life and what internalizes God's laws in our hearts, meaning that we no longer need the law because the law cannot change our hearts. Only the Spirit can. So I think that's the connection. I think that sits beneath it. Paul is reminding the Galatians that they've come to faith, not through law, but through the Spirit, through faith and through the Spirit. And they've received the Spirit to transform them. And that's what he wants to remind them of, not just personally, but also in their wider community life together. Our final question today is this: the vices are obvious except in us. No one thinks they're in a faction or idolatrous or sexually immoral, yet we know these exist in the church. How do we do better? I suppose the simplest answer is to say, keep in step with the Spirit. Probably the easiest answer to that. We want to be continuing to reflect upon the plans and purposes of God in the world, and about how our lives in all their facets reflect those plans and purposes. I think that's, you know, probably not a bad place to start. It's in the text and all that sort of stuff. I do think that it's helpful to be reminded that the fruit of the Spirit and the vices that Paul lists as well are given against the backdrop of community. That the fruit of the Spirit is not just about individual, personal holiness, but it's about a corporate expression of that. And, you know, I reckon that one of the things that's quite valuable for us is, of course, having other people in our lives who can gently point out our blind spots, who can, with love and grace, tell us that we may very well have a speck in our eye, possibly a beam, hard to say, that we have people in our lives to whom we can be accountable in some way, shape, or form. You know, just to be able to talk with other people about, you know, how we're going. And that's really valuable because, you know, the heart, as I think it's in Jeremiah, the heart is deceitful above all things. You know, we can convince ourselves that the people that we're hanging out with, we're not a faction. We're just a group of, you know, concerned citizens. You know, we've got some good things in mind. We have a good motivation, and therefore, like, we can deceive ourselves in all sorts of ways that what we're doing is fine, right? We can justify those things. And, you know, in the wisdom literature in particular, you know, one of the signs of wisdom is about loving correction, about having people around us who can say to us, hey, your motivation might be right, but the outcome's pretty lousy. You know, you might want the best, or you might say you want the best for the group, but the reality is you're just interested in your own motivation. Someone who can kind of point that out to us, and how we respond to that is really quite important as well. So I think that, you know, doing better, is related to keeping in step with the Spirit, broadly speaking. I think it's related to our relationships with one another. Yeah, and it's not that we're accountable to everyone in equal measure. You know, there is an element where we are all accountable to one another. You know, I think in our current context, you know, if you're a volunteer here at GBC, you go through the Safe Church compliance policies. in order to be recognized as a safe volunteer. And that's an example where, shall I say, we are all accountable to everyone, right? Inside and outside the church. You know, if someone drops their kids off at youth, like, we want them to know that we have safe volunteers. But in terms of, you know, our own individual discipleship, you know, it's not appropriate for everyone to have a say in everyone's life. There are people that you know a little bit. There are people that you know well. There are people that you know really well. And it's the people that we know really well and whom we trust deeply and whom we have a great deal of respect for that we can perhaps, you know, have those deeper conversations. So I think those are really important components of how we do better. I think that, you know, more broadly, I think there's value in reflecting on the fruit of those sorts of actions, the fruits of the flesh, the acts of the flesh. What are the outcomes that leads to? Because sometimes it's the outcomes that we see first. You know, we just kind of notice that things aren't working very well, and then we ask ourselves what's gone wrong, right? And we go back and we find out, oh, actually, it was this. This was the problem. Here was the action. So, you know, when we think about not necessarily royal commissions, but when there's an inquest into why something went wrong, when there's an internal probe into what happened to lead to this disaster, the fruit of it, the outcome, there's often a whole series of earlier decisions that get revealed. And so it's helpful for us to be thinking about, okay, what are the outcomes that we want to avoid in our lives individually, in our communities of faith, and then work backwards to say, okay, if we want to avoid these outcomes, then what are those actions that lead to different and better outcomes? So, you know, the child safe standards are a good example of that. If we want to avoid the fruit of, you know, abuse of children and those who are vulnerable, then we need to kind of work backwards to a whole set of actions that will hopefully lead to safety and to good relationships and, you know, protection for both ourselves and those who are in our care and all of those sorts of things. So I think that's a helpful way for us to think as well, to kind of consider what are the outcomes we want to avoid in our lives, and then working backwards then to say, you know, if I want to avoid the results of a sexually immoral life, you know, broken relationships or the shame associated with that or whatever it is, what are the actions that I need to make sure that I'm avoiding? I think that there's value in those sorts of things as well. Trying to be self-aware and to pay attention to the insidious justifications that our hearts can come up with, being accountable one to another in the appropriate kinds of ways, and staying in step with the Spirit are the kinds of things I think can help us to, you know, as the question asks, you know, how can we do better? You know, I suppose it's not just keeping in step with the Spirit, it's allowing the Spirit to continue to work in our hearts, right? To continue to restore and renew us, to continue to transform us to become more and more like Jesus, so that our lives, our values, our priorities, our behaviors are more and more aligned to the values, behaviors, and priorities of God Himself, as He seeks to restore and renew all things in Christ Jesus through the presence of the Spirit. So thanks again to those of you who submitted those questions. This coming week, we're going to start getting into the fruit of the Spirit. We're going to be looking at in the next couple of weeks at love, and then we'll begin looking at joy, and then we'll kind of race through the last few as we come to the end of this series. But trust it's been helpful and useful. Hope you can join us on Sunday as we begin to look through the fruit of the Spirit more specifically, whether that's on site or online. Love for you to join us. And of course, love for you to join me again next week for the Big Three. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.